everybody. Good evening. Mike Malloy here. Welcome to the program tonight. Glad you could make it. It's about 7 past the hour. I saw this thing today. It's the damnedest thing I have ever seen. I don't know if you're familiar with the Newsbusters, right? It's a it's one of these right-wing websites, and you know, it's kind of a sad place to go, but they have some funny stuff there occasionally, and an article that has showed up there today, the headline, here's the headline, leftist talker Mike Malloy wants Florida Gov Rick Scott drowned in a vat of turkey gravy. That's the headline. And then there's some clownish looking freak who wrote it, and it says, leftist radio talker Mike Malloy is really obsessed with executing conservatives. On Tuesday, Malloy wished death on Thanksgiving for Florida Governor Rick Scott. Then he quotes what I said. The Naples News reported Governor Scott made a Thanksgiving Day visit and joined a legion of volunteers at St. Matthew's House in East Naples, blah, 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 blah. And he quotes me as saying, and then this miserable son of a bitch has the audacity to go to a homeless shelter? It's a wonder somebody didn't hold his head down and have had a turkey gravy until he stopped struggling. And these clowns take this seriously. Oh, you poor, miserable turkeys. I mean, you really are. Oh, well. To the strange-looking man who wrote these what's his name? Tim Graham. Director of Media Analysis at the Media Research Center. Woohoo! Thanks for the publicity. But I love this headline. I've never seen anything like this. Leftist talker Mike Malloy wants Florida Governor Rick Scott drowned in a vat of turkey gravy. Jesus, God. Okay. You know, it's nice to have a little humor. This is not very funny. It is the season that, according to right-wingers, everybody is supposed to get all droopy and go buy things and celebrate the birth of the baby Jesus. And how do you celebrate the birth of the Christian Redeemer? By spending, buying, turning the retailers' ledgers from red to black. What else are you supposed to do? Make sure that every clerk who sells you something says, Merry Christmas! Rather than Happy Holidays. I mean, this really has become a very twisted, perverted time of year. Unless you divorce yourself from it. Unless you step back and say, okay, look. In the first place, the Christian Messiah was never born this time of year anyway. The person that they've designated to be the Messiah, not unlike the way certain Buddhists designate different children who are born to be the new Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of the Buddhists. Same thing here. The spiritual leader of the Christians, although there's only been one, according to them. So, it never occurred in December in the first place. So the whole Christmas thing, here's how you handle it if you're not a believer or if you've got some doubts. You might not be a full-blown crazy-ass atheist like me. You may be an agnostic. Okay, here's a way to do the Christmas holiday and still have a lot of fun. And we do. We really have fun with the Christmas holiday. We just celebrate the solstice part of it. The original part that was ripped away by the Christianization of the Celtic people and Northern European people. and all you decorate your bush, your tree, whatever you want to call it. Put wreaths out and fire in the fireplace if you live where it's cold, like we do here in Atlanta. And you have a good time. Have friends over, have hot chocolate or hot cider, or maybe an alcoholic drink if you're so inclined, and you have a good time. And if exchanging gifts is your thing, then you do that. You know, it's very possible to have a good time with Christmas. The folks in Scottsdale, Arizona, the Scottsdale Gun Club, they have a way of celebrating Christmas too. They're offering a chance for children and their families to pose for photos with Santa, while the children and the parents hold pistols and assault rifles. One of the images that's out there at Huffington Post shows Santa in a wingback chair with a snowflake background, a Christmas tree behind him, and flanked by an $80,000 machine gun and a tripod mounted rifle. Next to Santa is a man standing behind a little boy who's holding an unloaded, well, thank goodness, AR-15 with an attached grenade launcher. I mean, the son of a bitch. And people wonder why I say Christians are just so perverted and sick. I mean, they really are. Another image, Santa is cradling a toddler dressed in camouflage, while a man and woman stand close by with rifles with foldable stocks. In another image, five beaming young ladies pose with AR. One has an AR-15. An AK-47 variant, and other rifles as they surround old Saint Nick. You've got that up at our website?
Yeah, I had to post one of those, and I'm sorry, but I'm just trying to remember my Luke from the Bible, you know, the when the three wise men brought the frankincense, the myrrh, and the AK-47s.
Right.
To celebrate the birth of the tiny baby Jesus.
This is crazy. This is insanity. Ron Kennedy, the general manager of the Scottsdale Gun Club, said his business, or he got the idea for the photo op last year when a club member happened to come in dressed as Santa, and other members wanted their pictures taken while they were holding their guns. So he says, this freak, Kennedy, Ron Kennedy, this psycho, says, quote, "Our customers have been looking for a fun and safe way to express their holiday spirit and passion for firearms."
And of course,
and naturally, they thought of Christmas as the most wonderful time of the year to celebrate exploding things and making people dead.
God, I can't get over this. Oh, the guns in the photos aren't loaded, whew, and have had their firing pins removed, whew, and the chambers are regularly cleared to ensure safety. Now, of course, if you want to buy a semi-automatic rifle in the U.S., you got to be at least 18. For now, I'm sure the NRA is working on that. You know, if you're 12 years old and responsible, you should be able to buy a semi-automatic rifle.
Unless you're Rick Perry and the age is 21.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, you have to be at least 18. You cannot be a convicted felon. And the requirements for prospective buyers of fully automatic machine guns include being, you got to be 21, not a convicted felon, and you have to get a special license from federal firearms agents. Well, we'll NRA take care of that nonsense pretty quick. This is crazy. Oh, by the way, Democratic State Representative Steve Farley in Arizona, who proposed an unsuccessful ban on large-capacity gun magazines, like the one used in the January mass murder in Tucson that killed six people in an attempt to assassinate U.S. Representative Gabriel Giffords and 12 others, said the gun club's photo op was inappropriate. Representative Steve Farley said, quote, "To involve machine guns and Santa in a celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ is the worst kind of heresy I can imagine. I would suggest that the people who came up with this read some of the New Testament." End quote.
Everybody had a gun. Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
We wouldn't need the police no more because everybody would have a gun.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Get shot, cause everybody'd have a gun.
Makes sense. Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
We wouldn't need the police no more, cause everybody'd have a gun.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun? Wouldn't it be great if everybody had a gun?
Had a gun.
Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
21 past the hour. From Kay Petrini, our education affairs correspondent. You can read her stuff, by the way, at kaysreportcard.com. Mike, the other night you read the other night you read Bob Alexander's latest moment, in which he wrote about our inexorable march toward destruction. Bob wrote, quote, "It's the classic nightmare. We're going to our doom, but we can't seem to stop putting one foot in front of the other. Some of us are telling the others that we shouldn't keep walking up to the cliff, and some of us agree that we should stop, but we just keep walking in the same direction," end quote, Bob Alexander. Kay writes, "Those signs immediately caused me to flash back to grad school, specifically to a short story by Franz Kafka entitled A Little Fable. Here it is in its entirety. Alas, said the mouse, the whole world is growing smaller every day. At the beginning, it was so big that I was afraid. I kept running and running, and I was glad when I saw walls far away to the right and left. But those long walls have narrowed so quickly that I am in the last chamber already. And there in the corner stands the trap that I must run into. You only need to change your direction, said the cat, and promptly ate the mouse. In grad school, Kay writes, we had many debates about Kafka's message. Most students believed that Kafka was writing about the futility of resistance to those in authority. But some, including me, saw it differently. For example, I was struck by how willing Kay, the protagonist in Kafka's novel, The Castle, how willing Kay was to simply accept and do what he was told. I found myself wanting to shake Kay and ask him, why in the hell are you so passive? Why don't you challenge them? When I read A Little Fable for the first time, I found myself getting angry at the mouse for continuing to walk in the same direction despite being aware of the obvious dangers. That's when it occurred to me that A Little Fable might be viewed as a heavily abridged version of The Castle. The same message, the same warning, comes through loud and clear in both. Wake up and change direction. Do it now. To put that Kafka-esque message into Bob Alexander's words, quote, it's going to take occupy everything. Now, until the psychopaths understand we're not walking up to that cliff any longer, we're going to stop. And who doesn't agree had better come up with a different plan pretty quick. Because the feces-flinging monkeys and the placating liberals are going to grab you by the throat and shove you off that cliff if you don't voluntarily jump. End quote, Bob Alexander. Or, Kay writes, as Kafka wrote, the cat will finish you off. Kay. Her website, by the way, is kaysreportcard.com. There was a massive strike, general strike, public sector strike, disrupting services across England today. As reported by the BBC, tens of thousands of people took part in marches and rallies, strikes by public sector workers, including teachers, health staff, all over pension changes brought on by this right-wing freak Cameron, the new, or the relatively new, Prime Minister in England, in the UK. The Education Secretary, Michael Gove, said the action had a severe impact, with 76% of state-funded schools affected. The Trades Union Congress, the TUC, said the action followed a triple assault on public sector pensions. The government said the cost of public sector pensions had risen by a third in a decade, so changes were needed. Unions object to government plans to make their members pay more and work longer to earn their pensions. So hundreds of thousands of teachers, civil servants, immigration staff,
and some National Health Service workers walked out. Schools, hospitals, courts, passport offices, and ports were among services disrupted as hundreds of demonstrations were held across the country. And the Trade Unions Congress said more women than ever before had taken part in the strike. And it goes on. Estimates by the BBC, 2 million people. About 400,000 healthcare workers, including nurses and support staff, were on strike. 60,000 non-urgent operations, outpatient appointments and follow-up appointments, were believed to have been postponed. Scotland Yard said 35 protesters in East London were arrested on suspicion of breach of the peace. Parents, babies in prams, grandparents, people in wheelchairs and others pushing bikes all spilled out onto Deansgate shortly after 11:30 in the morning to demonstrate. They carried their banners overhead, waved flags, blew their vuvuzelas. Is that how you say that? Vuvuzelas, whatever, those big asinine-looking horns. In the Manchester sunshine, passersby stopped and clapped as the demonstrators filled one of the city center's main streets. The marchers had all come into town with one message for the government. Everyone deserves a decent pension. There's more here, and I'll show it with you when we come back.
Good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. We're going to have a guest on after the top of the next hour who was in solidarity with this massive strike in the UK today. She is with National Nurses United. It's Karen Higgins. She is the past president of the Massachusetts Nurses Association, and we're going to talk to her a little bit coming up at the top of the next hour. I wanted to get to this, though. I guess you know the Senate voted, was it last night? To keep the provision in the National Defense Authorization Act to allow the military to detain terrorism suspects on U.S. soil, hold them indefinitely without trial. Now, Obama has said he will veto this if it gets to his desk. 16 Democrats and an independent joined with all Republicans to defeat an amendment by Senator Mark Udall that would have killed that provision, the one about detention by the military indefinite with no constitutional protections whatsoever. Democrats were concerned about other Democrats who didn't vote in favor of this, were concerned about liberties, compared the military policing of Americans to the detention of Americans in internment camps during World War II. How many people remember, well, not remember it, but I'm sure you read about it in history, right? Some of our listeners have people who have relatives who were actually in that roundup. Japanese Americans who were, by order, by the way, of Franklin Roosevelt. Dianne Feinstein, Senator from California, said, quote, Congress is essentially authorizing the indefinite imprisonment of American citizens without charge. She offered another amendment, which has not yet gotten to vote, I guess. She said, quote, we are not a nation that locks up its citizens without charge, end quote. Well, actually, we are, Senator, since the Bush era. backers of military detention of Americans, people who really want this to happen, came out swinging against the Udall Amendment on the Senate floor earlier yesterday. Lindsey Graham, yeah, him again, Republican of South Carolina, said, quote, "The enemy is all over the world, here at home. And when people take up arms against the United States and are captured within the U.S., why should we not be able to use our military and intelligence community to question that person as to what they know about enemy activity? They should not be read their Miranda rights. They should not be given a lawyer. They should be held humanely in military custody and interrogated about why they joined Al-Qaeda and what they were going to do to all of us." Son of a bitch. This man's insane. Humanely, the way they are holding Bradley Manning. Yeah. What they did to Jose Padilla, or Padilla. Very humanely, they drove Padilla crazy. Insane. You want to know who the Democrats were who said, nah, let's hold the sons of bitches forever? Do you want to know who? Senator Bob Casey, Pennsylvania. I've seen him on television today talking about voting for a continuation of the payroll tax cut that Obama put into place a year ago. Bob Casey voted to lock up anyone and everyone and hold them with no charges, no constitutional protection. American citizens, God damn it, come on, let's put this where it is. Bob Casey, Ken Conrad, no surprise here. Kay Hagan of North Carolina, Daniel Inouye, a Japanese American who had a leg blown off fighting in World War II, voted to lock people up indefinitely, indefinite detention. That's astonishing. Herb Cole of Wisconsin. Mary Landrieu of Louisiana. Carl Levin, who was one of the authors of the bill, of Michigan. Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Claire McCaskill of Missouri. Robert Menendez of New Jersey. Ben Nelson of Nebraska. Mark Pryor of Arkansas. Jack Reed of Rhode Island. Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire. Wow. Debbie Stabenow of Michigan. Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. Joe Lieberman, of course. Senator John McCain emerged from this secret meeting. And here you go, where former Vice President Dick Cheney was in attendance. McCain said his colleagues had a spirited discussion about Udall's amendment. And he predicted nearly all Republicans would oppose the amendment, as they did. Dick Cheney was in attendance at the secret meeting. Cheney, as long as he is alive, will remain a threat to this republic. More of a threat than George Bush ever was. George Bush was just a little needle-nosed idiot. Dick Cheney comes out of a secret meeting. So, remember those senators, would you? Remember those senators. Bob Casey, Kent Conrad, Kay Hagan, Daniel Inouye, Herb Cole, Mary Landrieu, Carl Levin, Joe Manchin, Claire McCaskill, Robert Menendez, Ben Nelson, Mark Pryor, Jack Reed, Gene Shaheen, Debbie Stabenow, Sheldon Whitehouse, and soon-to-be history, Joe Lieberman. The Obama administration issued a statement that said, quote, "This unnecessary, untested, and legally controversial restriction of the president's authority to defend the nation from terrorist threats would tie the hands of our intelligence and law enforcement professionals. Moreover, applying this military custody requirement to individuals inside the U.S., would raise serious and unsettled legal questions and would be inconsistent with the fundamental American principle that our military does not patrol our streets." We have spent 10 years since September 11, 2001, breaking down the walls between intelligence, military, and law enforcement professionals. Congress should not now rebuild those walls and unnecessarily make the job of preventing terrorist attacks more difficult. And a White House official said Obama stands by his veto threat. Of course, if it passes with the veto-proof majority, then what? Given Obama's history, he immediately folds, gets up from the table, and walks away and says, well, the people have spoken. And doesn't exercise his veto pen, even though the chance would certainly exist that his veto would be overridden. But rather than force that issue, what do you want to bet? What do you want to bet? That if the Senate votes, and it's a veto-proof majority, and the bill eventually does get to his desk, that Obama will crap out like he has on so many issues. What do you want to bet? Huh? Well, there you have it. And just keep in mind the names of those Democrats. And some of you people wonder why still I've given up on the Democratic Party. Huh? Are you serious? You can't be serious. Are you serious? You really are serious, aren't you? Yeah, you are. What, you know, what will it take then to get your attention? If 16 Democrats have decided to become traitors. They took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. They have violated the oath. Is that treason? I don't know anymore. These 16 Democrats, actually, I don't give a goddamn about the Republicans. They are slime and filth. Not all Democrats are, although they're getting very close. So all of these people that voted in favor of this have just violated their oath of office. Haven't they? Haven't they? To uphold the Constitution? Somebody show me where in the Constitution this is legal. And while you're, after you search the Constitution and can't find it, then some good advice from a couple of our listeners. Go read some Kafka. Get familiar with his writings.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in. Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shirt?
Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, a couple of quick emails here from Till in Austin, Texas. Mike, just thinking ahead here, I wonder what the Obama apologists are going to say when he signs the National Defense Authorization Act, because it passes the Senate with a veto-proof majority. It'll be just like Clinton signing off on the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Obama will claim he is vehemently opposed to it, but claim there's nothing he can do. There will be no consideration that some Democratic senators may be swayed by a presidential veto accompanied by an impassioned plea for sanity and justice. As you often say, what's it going to take? Till in Austin, Texas. Yeah, Obama will just walk away from it. You know he will. From Bob Kincaid, Head on Radio Network. This is regarding Joe Manchin, who voted in favor of illegal, unconstitutional detention of Americans and anybody else who gets in the way. Mike, while some of the other Democrats you mentioned might be deemed surprising in supporting indefinite detention of American citizens, Joe Manchin is no surprise at all. After all, it was while Manchin was governor here in almost level West Virginia that nonviolent protesters against mountaintop removal were arrested and held in various jails on bonds in the amounts of tens of thousands of dollars, while a child sex abuser was granted bond and released on his own recognizance. While Manchin was governor, a woman who physically attacked Judy Bonds, a winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize, and hit her in the head, was grudgingly charged with misdemeanor battery, given a light fine, and told to go and sin no more. The same thing for a white supremacist mountaintop removal worker who threatened to slit the throat of a man and his 4.5-year-old son. Joe Manchin had his state police forces literally drag an 80-year-old woman in a wheelchair off to jail for daring to demand he stop the blasting and poisoning of our communities. First they came for the hillbillies, but I wasn't a hillbilly, so I said nothing. And all that follows, you know? Bob. The other Bob, Bob Kincaid, headonradionetwork.com. Yeah, well, Bob Kincaid is familiar with Joe Manchin for sure, because Bob Kincaid has been very active in the anti-mountaintop removal movement in West Virginia, to the point where, you know, I've spent time with Bob Kincaid and his family, and to the point where it makes me sometimes nervous as hell. I mean, it's one thing to get up and give a speech. It's something else, again, to go ahead and get arrested in front of the White House. It's something else, again, to give another speech at Occupy D.C., all of which I've done. But to do what Bob Kincaid has done, to get up on a stage in the lion's den, where people would be willing to shoot him dead and fight for what he's fighting for, Bob Kincaid, is something else again. So, by the way, you can his program's on right after this. Is it, doesn't White Rose stream it? I think so. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. I haven't mentioned that for a while. Jesus, God. If I got time to do, I don't think I do, Prairie 2's missive here. And not do it justice. I don't want to rush through this. So we'll wait. Coming up after the break, we're going to be joined by I have her name right here. I swear I do. Karen Higgins. She's a staff nurse at Boston Medical Center, a past president of Massachusetts Nurses Association. She has been actively involved with the MNA, Nurses Association, for nearly 20 years. Been a key player in all the important advocacy and legislative initiatives, from safe staffing to single-payer health care, and on and on and on. She is a fiercely loyal union sister, and she has been a leading voice at the MNA for the need for a strong national union. And today, in several cities around the United States, D.C., Boston, Chicago, L.A., Orlando, and San Francisco, there were support rallies in front of British consulates in those cities, rallies in support of the nearly 2 million people, British workers, who went on strike in the UK today. You know, 2 million, what's the population of the UK? 2 million people in the streets in the UK would be comparable to how many millions, relatively speaking, here in the U.S.? Anybody, I don't have the figures in front of me, but don't we have a population of about four times as great as the U.K.? I honestly don't know. But when you get too many, and to shut down, this is what we've been talking about for so long, to shut down sections of the country in protest of these fascist right-wing policies of David Cameron, the PM of the UK. What would it take? Oh, never mind. We'll be back momentarily. Stay with us. Seven past the hour. Karen Higgins is a staff nurse at Boston Medical Center. She's also a past president of the Massachusetts Nurses Association. She has been actively involved with the MNA for nearly 20 years and been a key player in all of its important advocacy and legislative initiatives. I could go on here for a while, but let's just bring her on. Hi, Karen.
Hey, how are you, Mike?
I was reading, I'm fine, thank you. I was reading a little bit earlier tonight from the BBC that this was a massive rally and marches and strikes that took place today in the UK. They're talking about upwards of 2 million people, which compared to, relatively speaking, population of the U.S., population of the U.K., I would imagine it would take about 10 or 12 million people in the United States to equal that. What was the action that National Nurses United here in the U.S. did in sympathy, I guess is the right word, with your counterparts in the U.K.?
We actually went to the British embassies in five different locations around the country. We had rallies going on in Boston, Chicago, Orlando, Florida, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and I had the pleasure of being in D.C. I went this morning, and we had a great showing at the British Embassy in Washington, which was great. So we had a contingency of a lot of not just public sector but private sector union members, and we also had the Washington Occupy group that was also there and joined us to, you know, show our support for those that are in the UK and watching what's going on over there to the public sector people and the government at this point trying to once again, as we're seeing over here, kind of in the same vein. It's like they're going after their public employees and trying to slash their pension, when in fact their pensions are have no problem with their funding whatsoever. So it's not that there's a problem funding them. It's once again, you know, they are in their financial problems as well, and they're basically using, trying to once again use, you know, whatever means they can, again, to offer those people that are working hard and not offer those people that caused all these problems.
The General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress in the UK, a guy named Brendan Barber, said, according to the BBC, he said, quote, "The brutal truth is simply this, that the living standards of millions of low and medium paid public service workers are being hammered in the name of reducing the deficit. The cuts are beginning to scythe through our public services. More and more jobs are under threat. And as the pay freeze bites, while inflation roars ahead, real wage cuts are making it harder than ever to make ends meet," end quote. Why do nursing professionals in this country feel it necessary to show solidarity with people in different countries? I know this is not the first action in sympathy with strikers, public health workers in different countries that American nurses have participated. Why is it necessary to show this kind of solidarity? We don't have American coal miners go on strike or show sympathy with coal miners in China. So why this?
Well, I think it goes back to, I think we've talked about this before, it's, you know, it goes back to the whole belief that as we're watching not only what goes on globally at this point, but, you know, specifically, we saw it in this country, is that as this continues and governments are trying to, you know, fix their problem, the problems that they cause, and how they're trying to fix it is, again, to cut into, you know, those people that still have jobs are still at threat of losing them. And if they do have them, at this point, we're not keeping up with the cost of living whatsoever. And people are struggling to survive. And I keep going back to this. As nurses, we see this every day. Mm-hmm. As families struggle, we're seeing the fallout where, you know, we see more patients, we see them sicker, we see them not taking care of themselves, not getting medical care, not getting medications. You know, I say the only thing that's growing in this country is food pantries and homeless shelters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unacceptable. And we're watching this not just happening here, but this is an example. It's happening globally. And, you know, we need to make a stand. As we watch what's going on over there, to see 2 million people on strike, and I actually was just online looking at all the pictures of, you know, the rallies that were going on over there. You know, it's phenomenal, and it is time, I think, that we realize that, you know, there is no borders even, you know, as they say, across the pond, there is no borders anymore. And we need to look very closely at what is going on, and just because we're in this country does not, we're not safe. We're not safe from seeing it happening more and more here. We've already seen it happening. We saw it happen in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, when the governors went after their public sector workers there, you know, in those states. And we've been able to, you know, some have been able to fight it back. But, you know, it's just one more thing that's dangerous. And as you cut all of these, you know, whether it's pensions, and I talked about this, if you, you know, cut people's pensions, and obviously people can't retire.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they work longer. And I can tell you honestly, when I'm 67, 68, 69, I'm a critical care nurse. I don't want you taken care of.
Yeah.
I don't want, you know, my ability to take care of you.
Sure.
And that's, you know, a lot of public services. It's the same thing. But if you can't afford to retire, then you're obligated to work as much as you can. The problem is, as long as I work, younger people cannot get those jobs because I'm forced into staying in them. So, you know, we're doing the same thing. We're putting ourselves in a gridlock. And then what happens when you do retire and you have a pension that doesn't cover the cost of living, you know, that causes a bigger problem. It goes right back to what we talk about. You know, then you don't care for yourselves. You don't get the medical care you need, or you don't get the medications that you need, or you don't, you know, have a house to live in anymore because you can't afford it. These are just all, you know, severe problems that just lead to bigger and bigger problems, you know, health-wise and in so many ways. And so we need to address it. And we feel strongly that we need to support each other. And it doesn't matter if it's in the United States or in the UK or where it is. But we need to all speak out about it.
Do you see the possibility or probability of other professional groups taking a more globalist attitude where it concerns these matters? There have been rallies and occupations in sympathy with the U.S. occupation movement around the globe. And now, of course, nurses seem to have either been in the vanguard or the actual leaders of this kind of support. Do you see other professional groups starting to be aware, God, I hope so, that this is a global, it takes a global action, global solidarity, because it's not the right or the left here. It is the entire system. In my opinion, this is just my opinion, the entire system has become so corrupted that something has to happen. And if the people, working middle class, the people that provide the sweat equity and do the heavy lifting, no matter if it's here or where it is, if they don't organize and reach out, then I don't know. I just get a sense of doom. I want you to answer that question, but I've got to take a break. Can you hold on?
Sure.
All right. Let me put you on hold. We'll come back. We're talking with Karen Higgins. She is a staff nurse at Boston Medical Center, past president of Massachusetts Nurses Association. We've chatted with Karen before, and this is ostensibly about the action that occurred in the UK today and the solidarity demonstrations in front of British consulates around the United States by American nurses today. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Let it be.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Yeah, humble and obedient. 21 past the hour. We're talking with Karen Higgins from the, among other organizations, Massachusetts Nurses Association. She's a past president. She also is a staff nurse at Boston Medical Center in that city. The population, I've been informed, of the UK is roughly 60 million. So the 2 million people they had on the streets today, Karen, would be comparable in this country of our having over 10 million in the streets. Would that that could possibly happen. The question, though, right before the break, do you foresee other professional groups in this country starting to form solidarity, in solidarity with groups, similar groups in other countries?
No, I think it is happening, and I think, you know, again, when we were out there, no matter where we were around the country today, you know, it wasn't the nurses standing alone. It was a lot of other groups that were with us, and I think, you know, whether it's good or bad, thanks to the internet and you know, Facebook and everything else, we are much smaller than we ever were before, and you know, as they were having their rallies, you know, over in the UK. They were getting already pictures of the groups in different places supporting them, and it's been, you know, bouncing back and forth. So I think it is already happening. I think, you know, the world is much smaller because we can communicate much more quickly with each other as things happen. And I think that helps, you know, make people feel that it's, that they become part of. And, you know, I think this issue is global. And, you know, we are seeing more and more groups getting involved. Obviously, right now, it's been more union groups, but I think you're going to see more and more because, I you know, this battle is not over, over there or over here. And we need to continue to, you know, show that this is not the direction this country should be going in or any country should be going
in. And, so, you know, Karen, the other thing that really this drives me crazy, why don't American workers, that's what I'm talking about now, see and understand that being a member of a union gives you that group structure within which you can actually put yourself out there and make demands for change. An individual, one person picking up a picket sign, well, good on him or good on her. But when you have 10,000 people show up, or 5,000, or a million, or whatever, you know, the public sector, so-called, is the last redoubt of unionized workers, of organized workers. And that's a damn shame because, you know, I grew up in an era when the workforce was about 33-34% unionized, which meant it was strong enough to influence all workers, whether, you know, the wages that all workers got up to a point. In certain sections of the country, that didn't happen. But if you didn't work in a union shop, then you could always leave and go to work in a union shop to get the same kind of pay and benefits. So a lot of places that weren't unionized adopted the union standard. And I don't understand why American workers, and I don't care what they are, I don't care if they're white collar, blue collar, pink collar, whatever you want to call it, why there is not more emphasis placed on the importance of being in a union. I just can't get that, you know?
Well, I think, unfortunately, you know, I think at some point in time in history or at different times, unions, unfortunately, I think at times got, you know, a bad reputation. And and in most cases, very unfounded. But it's a very powerful way of trying to make, you know, union workers, whether it's public or private, somehow be the bad guy. And we saw this. I mean, you were seeing this when everything was going on in Wisconsin. It was the same thing. All of a sudden, you know, these public workers, and who are they? The people that, you know, when your house is burning down, they're the ones that run in to try to save you and your home, or, you know, if someone's robbing you, it's the police that are there, and, you know, we have, you know, nurses that are, you know, working and trying to help people, teachers that are trying to teach your children, and at a little point in time, you started to see that suddenly they were the problem, and it's how you kind of had to stop for a minute and say, what are you thinking? And luckily, the tides were turned, and people finally realized that, you know, don't buy into this. This is what was being put out there to publicly make them look bad. But the hottest thing I think that's going on is, again, in this country, is that, you know, you're not seeing as much because the jobs are gone. You know, you've seen a lot of unionized, you know, companies that have closed or jobs have been sent overseas. And I think, you know, unfortunately, has caused a decrease in numbers, which has made it extremely hard. But I think that, you know, like I said, everywhere I go to these rallies, whether, you know, it's in Washington and Boston, no matter where you go, you never stand alone anymore, and the numbers are getting bigger and bigger, and it's more and more.
Yeah,
public and private, you know, both public and private unions that are now standing there saying,
let's hope that continues. Karen?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Karen, it's always good to have you on. I've got a break here. Listen, thank you so much. I know we're going to talk
again.
You're
more than welcome. It's always great talking to you.
Take care, okay?
Bye-bye.
All right, Karen, bye-bye. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Singing in the dead of night. take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Doesn't Newt Gingrich really piss you off? I mean, his arrogance. We're going to get into that a little bit next hour. I want you to hear some sound from this lizard. From Prairie 2, a.k.a. Bruce Enberg. Subject line, that sign on your back says target of opportunity. Bruce writes, 2 million public sector workers in Britain shut that country down today. They are striking over the planned tightening of the already insane austerity plans of the Conservative government there. The most hard-hit sectors were schools, healthcare, and border control. Police were making arrests, but lawyers were picketing in front of the Crown Prosecutor's Office, and the rumor is that sympathetic judges weren't hearing cases. The Dow jumped almost 500 points today on news that the Federal Reserve is going to print more U.S. dollars and loan them to the other big central banks or swap them for euros. One problem with this story is that program is already in place. The slight drop in interest rates announced today is insignificant. So what is everybody all excited about? It could mean that the European Central Bank, the ECB, is going to start loaning money to the countries in trouble from soaring bond rates, but they could just print euros to do that. Italy's bond rate has not declined at all on the news. The problem has been that the ECB has been steadfastly refusing to make loans. In fact, they started the snowball rolling downhill last spring when they jacked up interest rates. The ECB based this high interest rate policy on nothing but the conservative talking point that we were going to see runaway inflation from increased government spending. The numbers don't support any of this. It was simply dogma worthy of Glenn Beck, you know, the spiel. Panic, panic, runaway inflation, be afraid, buy gold for my sponsors, blah, blah, blah. Deflation continues to be the real problem as the world deleverages from the massive credit bubble created by Alan Greenspan and the other conservative devotees of Ayn Rand. Another reason the pundits are giving for the Fed action is that no banks will lend on the overnight market to European-owned banks in New York City, and they in turn are afraid to borrow from their own ECB in euros. They point to the credit freeze for the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008. Personally, I think Lehman Brothers' collapse had something to do with leveraging 80 to 1. The days before Republicans controlled Congress, the limit was 10 to 1. And then conservatives modernized the financial markets. The most likely reason for the timing of this non-event by the Fed was just to counter Standard & Poor's downgrade of the big zombie banks. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan shares were both up by more than 6% today. And Bank of America shares were up by 5.5%. All three zombies currently have huge derivative exposure of $75 trillion for Bank of America and $85 trillion for J.P. Morgan. These are dollars we're talking about here. They're also being sued for screwing various big money clients with derivatives in the past with potential liability in the billions, not to mention the potential, however remote, possibility that the government might actually hold them criminally responsible for their fraud. Not likely to happen, but it's bad for the stock price. It could be that they are in fact gearing up to dump the euro, and then everybody who owes euros will need to pay back the zombie banks and the suddenly strong U.S. dollar. Sort of like lending nickels and demanding payment in dimes. Nice racket if you're in the top 0.1%, not so good for us 99.9% peasants. They can't really get paid in cash that way, but they forced Greece to turn over all its public assets to them to pay them off, so you'll probably see a lot more privatization. It's really just privateering. That's piracy sanctioned by the state. The 1% owns the state, and the 99% are targets of opportunity. PrairieNumeral2.com is his website. Go chat with him. Yeah, 500. What was the close today? Almost 500 point increase in the Dow Jones. Oh yeah, yeah. Look at all the jobs that were created today. Oh my gosh. Oh my golly. See, you and I are pretty much blocked from getting news about what's happening in the EU. We hear bits and snatches, but most of it, you have to admit, kind of goes over our heads. Come on. That's why it is imperative that Prairie 2 keeps providing us with information, whether we want to hear it or not. I mean, where else are you going to get it? Well, you can sit and watch CNBC all day. But for some reason, you know, our education system decided to keep us ignorant about how capitalism really works. And I guess there's a reason for that. If we understood how it really worked, we would say, ah, no thanks. You know, just like talking with Karen Higgins last half hour. I was so tempted to ask her, well, do you hear echoes? Because I do. Of workers of the world unite. The only thing you have to lose are your chains. Anybody get that sense? Ooh. When was that written? In the 1840s? 1850s? But we don't understand our own economic system. You and I don't. We really don't. I mean, we get little bits and snatches maybe, but we don't know what the hell's going on. You know you don't. When somebody says to me, well, there's, you know, Bank of America has a $40 trillion exposure in derivatives, I just sit there and glaze over. I have no idea what the hell they're even talking about. All I know is, because it's been shown to me now, that when those $40 trillion in derivatives come due, probably the American public is going to be on the hook for that. And I do know that this all comes because of the deregulation of this filthy, disgusting banking industry. These sons of bitches that are just destroying everything. Why do we allow this to keep going? We don't have to understand it to destroy it, do we? I mean, do we have to understand it? You know, the decorporatization of America is almost a requirement if we're ever going to get out of this. And I don't know that that's going to happen. And yet, you find out on Monday that the American public just went bat guano crazy, going into debt for their Jesus celebrations. I don't get this. I just don't get it. I don't get it at all. But I do know that there is something very, very dangerous afoot, and it's like the piece that Bob Alexander wrote about just the debate seems to be not let's change course, but let's change speed as to how fast we're walking towards the edge of the cliff. That's madness, isn't it? And, you know, all of a sudden, do you get this sense? All of a sudden, all these so-called debates and this back and forth horse crap with the Republican presidential candidates is just so much superfluous bull hockey. Do you get that feeling, too? I mean, you listen to these people. You listen to what's making news about them. You know, Newt Gingrich considers himself to be a celebrity, and the pizza man is just walking around like, "Wow, man, I'm gonna," you know, his latest story. The Democrats don't want me to run against Obama. They don't want me to be president. I mean, how crazy do you have to be before somebody pulls your chain and says, get your ass back in your crawl space? You've had your 15 minutes. Sit down. Shut up. I know Stephen Colbert would have a nervous breakdown if Herman Cain gets out of the race. You know, a lot of comedians would. But my God, when you seriously, when you look at this field of potential nominees or a field of candidates that want to be the nominee, who among that group of Republicans has a sense of a sack full of cactus stickers? I mean, who does? Sack full of what? I don't know. Poor John Huntsman. Buddy, you just picked the wrong year. you just picked the wrong year. Seems like a decent guy, doesn't he? Of course, he's a religious fanatic, but, you know, who isn't these days? Oh, and, I know this was church night. We didn't get to it, but maybe we'll do church night tomorrow. But there was one thing here. Did you hear the latest from this psycho Santorum? Where'd it go? I'll find it. Have we got a break? Okay, do the break and we'll come back and do this. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour. So one more clown act here for this hour. Rick Santorum is urging the teaching of creationism in public schools. He is indeed. According to Huffington Post, Santorum says that the left and the scientific community, ooh, now there's an unholy alliance, that they have monopolized the public school system's curriculum, only permitting the teaching of evolution and leaving no room for the introduction of creation-based theories in the classroom. He said, quote, "There are many on the left and in the scientific community, so to speak, who are afraid of that discussion because, oh my goodness, you might mention the word, God forbid, God in the classroom or creator. That there may be some things that are inexplainable by nature and where there may be where it's actually better explained by a creator. And of course, we can't have that discussion," end quote. Hey, look, ass, you can have that discussion any place you want to, okay? Pollute your own children's minds, slick, all right? Any Christian fundamentalist who wants to have that discussion, go goddamn have it. And if you don't like what's taught in the public schools, get your little angels out of the public schools. Homeschool them. Go hire somebody and teach them in your church basement. Get your ass out of the faces of people who go to public schools because they want to go to a public school. When did these freaks decide they were going to jam their phony ass religion in everybody's face? See, I get so tired of this. You know what I'm saying? Santorum said in an editorial interview with the Nashua Telegraph, New Hampshire, quote, "It's very interesting that you have a situation where science will only allow things in the classroom that are consistent with a non-creator idea of how we got here, as if somehow or another that's scientific." What? Well, maybe the science points to the fact that maybe science doesn't explain all these things. What? And if it does point to that, then why don't you pursue that? What? but you can't because it's not science. But if science is pointing, you know there is. But if science is pointing you there, how can you say it's not science? It's worth the debate. No, it isn't. That's a direct quote from this half-ass. No, it's not worth the debate, moron. You don't talk gibberish. Debating gibberish is not a debate. Sitting around saying, well, maybe science points to the fact that maybe science doesn't explain all these science things. And if that does point to that, then why don't you pursue that? But you can't because it's not science. But if science is pointing you there, how can you say it's not science? That's worth debate? No, it's not. That's the time you get out the meds. When somebody's talking like that, you give them a pill, slick. Santorum has long expressed frustration with and tried to combat the whole, quote, science only allows science to be taught in science class scenario. Yeah, well, that's why they call it science class, you jerkwad. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Ah! You attempted to append the self-titled Santorum Amendment to the No Child Left Behind Act back when he was a senator in 2001. The amendment served the dual purpose of promoting the inclusion of intelligent design teachings in classrooms while simultaneously undercutting the academic merits of evolution. Intelligent design? You know, that term is a contradiction. In the manner in which it's used, intelligent design, what does that mean? Well, Mike, you unbelieving atheist bastard, I'll tell you what intelligent design means. It means that there is this huge, white, bearded, half-naked, muscular dude who sits up in the sky. You know what he looks like? Michelangelo showed you what he looks like. And he sits up there and he creates stuff. Planets and dogs and mountains and rice grains and stuff like that. That's what intelligent design is, you atheist chump. Malloy. Where in the hell do we live? Where do we live? You know, a real act of courage, or maybe it's perseverance, is just maintaining your sanity these days. You know, finding whatever it takes to maintain sanity while this economic, religious, political swamp just seems to want to suck everything into it. This is good. It's just crazy. Just crazy. Listen, when we come back, Maureen Dowd went after Newt today, but I'm going to strip his skin off. So, I'll tell you some things about his personal life, too. Newt Gingrich personifies. He is the intelligent design. He is the corporeal reality of the worst corrupt example of a politician in this country's history. We'll talk a little more about that when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. back, and of course, Newt Gingrich. What a slob this guy is. I mean, there is just no question. If you wonder what Occupy is all about, when they talk about the corruption in politics, among other things, the corruption in our leadership cadre, there is no clearer example of that corruption and filth and degeneracy than this bloviating, self-important Newt Gingrich. And now all of a sudden, because everybody in the Republican field are either, trying to become the party nominee for president in 2012, every one of them is either a clown or an ignoramus or some kind of a religious freak or, with the exception of John Huntsman. Isn't that a shame? Poor John Huntsman. Mr. Huntsman, you picked the wrong year. You picked the wrong year. Anyway. Now we have Newt. Now that, the latest number two, who was it that said this morning that being number two in the Republican sweepstakes here is about as short-lived as being number three in Al-Qaeda? Was that Joe Scarborough? Somebody wrote that for him. He's not that smart. He's not that witty. So I'm sure somebody wrote it for him. Well, it doesn't matter. It's a good line. So now that Herman Cain somehow has become a victim of all these women who apparently got together someplace and decided to lie on his ass, let's all get together and lie on Herman. Let's talk some, according to Herman, that's exactly what happened. I don't know what happened. I thought Ginger was my friend. I thought Ginger was my friend. And, when somebody's your friend, they're supposed to keep the goddamn mouth shut. That's right. They're lying on me, all of them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I digress. So anyway, here comes Newt, the old plotter, old rotund, bloviating, self-important Newt who considers himself a celebrity. I'll show that to you in a second, or I'll let you hear it in a second. But Gingrich is now number two. You know, the irony of all this, old Mitt Romney just keeps floating around at his, number one position, 25, 26, 27%, 28%, while the freak show beneath him just continues. In January of 1997, the House of Representatives voted to discipline Newt for being an unethical, lying scum. He was also the speaker. He was accused of using tax-deductible charitable donations to fund a non-charitable college course that he taught, and of giving false information about this to the House Ethics Committee. So the House voted, and by a vote of 395-28, they condemned this pig and ordered him to pay an unprecedented $300,000 penalty as part of a settlement to avoid a full hearing. Avoid. Now, think about this scum sucker up against the president at the time, Bill Clinton. Clinton had to go through an impeachment process and a trial because he fudged the truth about what was going on between him and Monica Lewinsky. Newt Gingrich, on the other hand, is a con artist, a liar, a thief, a sneak, violated House rules, took money under false pretenses, committed fraud. The IRS had an investigation until that was squashed. And what does he get? $300,000 fine as part of a settlement to avoid a full hearing. Oh, Newt would have got on his knees in front of Henry Hyde and did whatever was necessary to avoid a full hearing. Trust me on that one. 84 ethics charges were filed against Newt Gingrich during his term. 84. Wow. This is your new charging Republican nominee. Republican Party, you see, is it represents nobody except massive corporate capitalist interests. And every single one of their candidates is flawed, not flawed, rotten to the core. Just absolute, with the exception of John Huntsman. John, you picked the wrong year. You really did. That's a shame, buddy. So here's Newt. The House Ethics Committee concluded that the lies that he told investigators represented, in the words of the House Ethics Committee, quote, intentional or reckless disregard of House rules. In other words, he was a liar, a big fat liar. There was a special counsel. Remember those special counsels? Huh? Remember? Special prosecutor, special counsel. That Republicans got rid of that idea real quick, didn't they? Special counsel James Cole concluded that Gingrich violated federal tax law and lied in an effort to force the ethics committee to dismiss the complaint against him. Now, when the second day, I've used her as an example, but when Martha Stewart lied to the FBI, she went to prison. When Newt Gingrich lies his ass off, is stealing money hand over fist, is a common thief, a liar, commits fraud, he gets nothing. Now, the full committee panel did not agree whether tax law had been violated and left that issue up to the IRS. And about 2 years later, I guess in 1999, the IRS cleared the organizations that Newt headed, connected with the college course, Renewing American Civilization, under investigation for possible tax violations. In the summer of 1997, going back now, this was after 6 months after the House disciplined him for lying, cheating, sneaking, stealing, being a thug. In the summer of 1997, several House Republicans who saw Gingrich as a liability tried to replace him as Speaker. And this attempted coup began July 9th with a meeting of Republican Conference Chairman, Republican Conference Chairman John Boehner, yeah, him, and Republican Leadership Chairman Bill Paxton of New York. According to their plan, now remember, when you strike at the emperor, make sure you kill him. According to their plan, House Majority Leader Dick Armey, House Majority Whip Tom DeLay, yeah, him, Boehner and Paxton were to present Gingrich with an ultimatum: get out or be voted out. However, Dick Armey balked at the proposal to make Paxton the new speaker, and told his chief of staff, Army's chief of staff, to warn Gingrich and to Brute about the attempted coup. You know, now think about the leadership of the Republican Party. We got Dick Armey, got Boehner, Dick Armey, who is nothing but a neo-fascist thug, John Boehner, a drunk, majority House dude Tom DeLay, who's under how many indictments? Now you have Gingrich. I mean, it just goes on and on. Now, in his personal life, a lot of people have some questions about Newt Gingrich's personal life, right? We'll get to that after we come back from this break. And then I have something I want you to hear. Newt is the kind of elitist that just makes you gag. He may be a smart man in certain areas, but he's just a complete ass. You know what I'm saying? A total jackass. And every time he opens his mouth, he proves it with that holier-than-thou kind of puffed-up attitude of his, like, oh, well, I'm a celebrity. Yeah, he thinks he's a celebrity. Matter of fact, he uses that term to describe himself. You'll hear it in a minute.
Radical Talk Radio, it's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Talking about Newt Gingrich, the once and current rising star of the Republican field of half-wits and morons. Big article about him in this morning's New York Times, of course, that kind of peels back the curtain and lets you see this bloated, self-important freak who is nothing more, nothing less than a lobbyist who works in the highest echelons of corruption and crap and graft and filth in Washington and wants to be president, of course. Some personal information, some of which you may or may not know. Most of us in Georgia know all about this creep. And surprising, a lot of people here love it. They just think, well, you know, Gingrich is a Christian now, so Jesus will forgive all of his transgressions. That's the wonderful thing about Christianity, you see. Gingrich has been married three times. In 1962, he married his high school geometry teacher. he was, I think he was 18 at the time. She was like 26, 27. I don't know. The ages are not all that significant, except for the fact it was his geometry teacher. Now, think about that for a second. Every time I pick up the paper and some geometry teacher is, or some school teacher is, you know, involved with one of her students or one of his students, that teacher usually hits a brick wall as far as career is concerned, or worse, but then again, not in this case. So anyway, Gingrich and his first wife, Jackie Battley, have two daughters. In the spring of 1980, 18 years later, Gingrich left her after being involved for a sustained period of time in an affair with a woman named Marianne Ginther. And Miss Battley, his first wife, told the Washington Post a few years ago that the divorce was, quote, a complete surprise to her, end quote. According to Jackie Battley, in September 1980, Gingrich and their children visited her while she was in the hospital recovering from cancer surgery, and Gingrich said he wanted to discuss the terms of their divorce. Then, immediately, recovering from cancer surgery. And according to a person named L.H. Carter, who was Gingrich's campaign treasurer, Gingrich said of his soon-to-be ex-wife, quote, "She's not young enough or pretty enough to be the wife of the president. Besides, she has cancer," end quote. Gingrich has denied saying it, just like Herman Cain has denied this massive conspiracy of women who are coming from every direction. All these liars. Well, Gingrich fell in with the same group of liars, apparently, because he said, no, I didn't say that. Of course I didn't. She's not young enough or pretty enough to be the wife of the president. Besides, she has cancer. Jesus Christ. Go ahead, vote for him. Go ahead, Republicans, vote for this animal. 6 months after the divorce, he finally got his divorce from his cancer-stricken wife. 6 months after the divorce was final, Gingrich got married to the woman he was having the affair with, Marianne Ginther. And that was in 1981. In the mid-90s, Gingrich began an affair with an intern, the House of Representatives, I think, Agriculture Committee, an intern named Calista Bysik, who is quite a bit his junior, kind of like you and me, Kathy, quite a bit his junior in terms of age. They continued their affair during the Lewinsky scandal when Gingrich became a leader of the investigation of Bill Clinton for perjury in connection with his affair with Monica. And old righteous Gingrich was out there, the celebrity, the hypocritical rat bastard, huh? And then in 2000, Gingrich married his intern, Calista, shortly after his divorce from Marianne. So, for you family values people, you hypocritical rats, you skunks, you cockroaches, you people that wander around saying, well, if the queers are allowed to get married, it's going to destroy traditional marriage. Are you kidding? Are you serious? Here's your boy Gingrich. Now go vote for him. Go ahead. Vote for him. Because, you know, you're probably right. If gay folk were allowed to form a contract of marriage, it probably would have a very, very negative effect on hetero marriages, wouldn't it? Huh? Wouldn't it now? You idiots. We'll be right back where Newt identifies himself as a celebrity. Stick around.
Everywhere. I do not like them on my station. I do not like them in my nation. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, Newt Gingrich. So I think we've established here that he is a liar. He is a perjurer. He is commits fraud whenever he feels like it. He's not a very nice man where it concerns his interactions with his women. He's been fined in order to cover up and prevent a full hearing into his fraudulent activities when he was in the House. I mean, it just goes on and on. In other words, he is a classic Republican. He's a liar, a cheat, a sneak, a fornicator. Ooh, I love that word. He's a fornicator. He's an adulterer. And again, this is the perfect, hypocritical Republican candidate for president. And the only reason we even talk about Newt is because he is on an upward surge. Now, we're going to play for you a couple of minutes from Morning Joe this morning on MSNBC. Joe Scarborough, who was one of the Republican members of Congress back in the day, who wanted to get rid of Newt Gingrich for whatever reason. So keep that in mind as you listen to this. But this is This Morning with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski and Tina Brown and the Newsweek editor. And who are the two guys that sit there with him all the time? Can't think of their names. It's immaterial. Let's listen.
Speaking at a campaign event in South Carolina yesterday, Gingrich said he simply didn't need the money.
The $100 million?
Doesn't need it. No. He didn't need the money badly enough to become a lobbyist.
I did no lobbying of any kind, period, for a practical reason. I'm going to be really direct, okay? I was charging $60,000 a speech. And the number of speeches was going up, not down. Normally, celebrities leave, and they gradually sell fewer speeches every year. We were selling more.
Because he's a celebrity.
Yeah. Normally, celebrities leave. But
I love selling speeches, too.
He calls himself a celebrity, so Newt Gingrich makes $60,000. Here's what's so fascinating. Mike, we talked about this before. If you look at the average wages of people in South Carolina where he's speaking, Newt Gingrich said that he made $60,000 for basically a 30-minute speech. Now, if you go to South Carolina, you can see that in 30 minutes, Newt Gingrich cashing in on his access in Washington, D.C. and speaking to special interest groups that want to hear him speak. Mm. Per 30-minute speech, Newt Gingrich earned twice as much as a truck driver in South Carolina makes all year, working night and day, driving trucks all around. In one 30-minute speech, Newt Gingrich cashing in on his access made $12,000 more in 30 minutes of speaking before special interest groups than an elementary school teacher made the entire year in South Carolina. A registered nurse. Think about how hard registered nurses work, Mike. Year around, Newt Gingrich is saying, because he's a celebrity, and he gives a 30-minute speech and makes $60,000, he's making more than a registered nurse makes all year, cleaning bedpans, going room to room, doing difficult, and you could go on, administrative assistant, Newt makes, I mean, this is bragging about making $60,000 a speech because you're a, quote, celebrity, when actually what you're doing is you're part of a corrupt process, a revolving door process, where you go from being speaker, giving people access, as the New York Times says, giving speeches in front of special interest groups, making $100 million.
And Joe Scarborough, keep in mind, is a Republican, is a conservative. Oh, the only thing, Joe, nurses don't clean bedpans. Aides do that, or students do that, but nurses don't do that, but that's right. Well, all right, private duty, but we're talking about a hospital here. We're talking about hospital nurses. They don't clean bedpans. But anyway, the person there that you're listening to, this is not Michael Moore talking. This is not Greg Palast talking. This is not Michael Malloy talking. This is Joe Scarborough talking. Jesus God. $100 million. Oh, but he's not a lobbyist. No, he's a celebrity. According to the Times this morning, Newt is adamant that he's not a lobbyist, but he is a visionary who traffics in ideas. That's right. He's a celebrity. He's a visionary. He's a blowhard. He's a liar, a fraud, a cheat, a sneak. Unprecedented fine against him by the House Ethics Committee in order to prevent a full-blown hearing into his fraudulent activities as an elected representative. Back in the 90s. In the 8 years since he started, he has this healthcare consultancy. Healthcare. Right. Healthcare. In the 8 years since he started it, he's made millions of dollars. Millions of dollars helping companies promote their services and gain access to state and federal officials, different kinds of so-called healthcare companies who are not involved in health care at all. They're involved in the pharmaceutical industrial complex. They're involved in making people sick and sicker under the guise of being a healthcare company. So Gingrich has used his access, as Joe Scarborough mentioned, as former Speaker of the House, to get in front of state legislators and decision makers who are making these great decisions about what to do with the few remaining tax dollars that other Republicans have tried to diminish down to zero. And there's Newt sucking in his share so that he can have a six-figure open account at Tiffany's, among other things. But he's not a lobbyist. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, no. Among other things, according to Times, Gingrich arranged meetings between executives and officials and gave presentations to lawmakers that included pitches for his clients. Oh, but I'm not a lobbyist! The clients pay as much as $250,000 a year to belong to Newt's Center for Health Transformation. Center for Health Transformation. Jesus Christ. I wonder who he's boinking right now. Of course, he's so... Well, he's too ugly to be president. And besides, he might have cancer. Oh, no, wait. That's what he said about his second wife. That's right. No, his first wife. That's right, his first wife. She was too ugly to be the wife of the president. Because Newt is such an Adonis. Isn't he? Isn't he just so handsome? Girls, when you look at Newt, doesn't your heart flutter? Don't you get kind of weak in the knees and, you know, other stuff that happens, right? When you look at Newt, doesn't he just make you go, oh, pity Pat, pity Pat, pity Pat, be still my beating heart. So Newt decided that his first wife was too ugly, and besides she had cancer, to be the wife of the next president of the United States. This guy is scum. This guy makes Herman Cain look honorable. This guy makes Rick Perry look like a decent man. This guy makes Sic Santorum look almost legitimate. This is Newt Gingrich. There is not a scummier, filthier politician of either party alive today who comes close to Newt Gingrich. Gingrich and his aides repeatedly are talking about, well, he's not a lobbyist. No, no. They say he has never taken a position for money and that corporations have signed on with him because of the strength of his ideas. The strength of his ideas. Oh, my God. That's how you make $100 million a year, is, or whatever it was, as Joe Scarborough said. Scarborough, who knows Newt far better than I do. I mean, I know Newt. I lived in the same city with him. It was on Newt's back that Sean Hannity rode to his fame and fortune. I've told that story before. Back when Newt was being assailed left and right, there was only one person in media who took pity on him and provided him a forum to speak his piece, and that was Sean Hannity, a little 5,000-watt radio station here in the Atlanta area. And as a reward for all that, when Newt started his publishing career and his consultancy career, he had a good friend named Roger Ailes who was starting a television network called Fox Television. And Newt said, I've got this real pretty boy down here who's dumber than a sack full of doorknobs, but he really helped me, so he'll do anything we tell him. Give him a job. And thus the baby Jesus was born. That's what we used to call him here, the baby Jesus. Not Newt, Sean. And then those pictures of him out of the bunny ranch in Reno, Nevada show up. I think I have those up on my website. Sean and the whores, the litter, the prostitute, you know, the sex workers. But I digress. This Republican Party is great, isn't it? Huh? Vote Republican! Oh, hell yes! All you Family Values crowd, this is your man right here. Here he is, all you Christians. Here he is. Hallelujah. Here he is. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you Newt. She's too ugly to be wife of the president. She has cancer anyway. Gingrich. I mean, we've had very strange mixtures of human DNA who thought that they were deserving of or capable of being president of the United States of America. But Newt Gingrich is unique. He truly is. He is unique. I don't know how to describe him. I really don't, except with one word: corrupt. All the way down to the soles of his feet. This is a corrupt man, whether it is morally corrupt, ethically corrupt, intellectually corrupt, psychologically corrupt. I mean, the man is a walking definition of the word corrupt. And therefore, he is the perfect candidate for the Republican Party to become president of the United States. He really is. In asserting, according to the Times, in asserting that Gingrich is never engaged in lobbying, you know, he makes his millions because he's such a goddamn genius, and people like to gather at his feet and touch the hem of his robe and look up into his beatific face and say, ah, master. That's how he gets paid. Anyways, aides say he's never engaged in lobbying. And his aides say lawyers have thoroughly vetted all of Newt's activities. Randy Evans, another one of these Georgia lawyers who's represented Gingrich since his days as House Speaker. Randy Evans said that none of Gingrich's clients ever paid him to adopt a position he did not already have. Right. Another Georgia lawyer. Evans, the lawyer, said that when Mr. Gingrich appeared to be promoting the services of his clients before state lawmakers, he was merely citing examples to buttress his ideas. So, get the sentence. When Gingrich appeared to be promoting the services of his clients before state lawmakers, he was merely citing examples to buttress his ideas, and that the companies he represented weren't paying him to do that. No, of course not. Newt was doing this because, well, Newt is a goddamn genius, and Newt likes the idea exchange. He likes to stand in front of a bunch of half-witted, oh, Georgia legislators and say, well, I'll tell you what, boys, here's what you ought to do. These companies that I represent, huh, they got some really good X, Y, and Z that y'all ought to, well, you can fill in the last word. If you want to say bye, go ahead. I'm not saying bye, but you may want to say bye. Thoroughly vetted. Old Newt. And the companies weren't paying him. The ones that paid him millions upon millions upon millions of dollars were not paying him to push their services and products to state lawmakers. If Newt mentioned these products in front of the state lawmakers, it was merely examples to buttress Newt's ideas about how the world really works. Tony Evans, the lawyer, went on to say, any interactions that Gingrich had with members of Congress or federal officials or state officials on matters important to his clients, quote, followed specific protocols and procedures, end quote, that Newt's organization designed to ensure that he stayed within the law. Aw, isn't that so goddamn sweet? I mean, doesn't that just bring tears to your eyes because of the sweetness of it? The sweetness of wanting to always be ethical and stay within the guidelines of the law. Newt, you're just amazing. So apparently, according to this lawyer, Tony Evans, Newt traveled with a group of lawyers who vetted every word that he said, every sentence, everything that came out of his mouth to make sure that Newt stayed within ethical guidelines. Now, think about that for a second. Traveling with a crew of people whose sole function is to make sure that in your speaking, you stay within ethical guidelines. Yes, this is a family values Republican. Absolutely. And a Christian. Absolutely. Absolutely. And according to the Times, as Newt's policy interests increasingly focused on, quote, health care, end quote, which has nothing to do with health and has nothing to do with care, but everything to do with exploitation, thievery, lying, fraud, deception, has nothing to do with healthcare. Get real. However, in that endeavor, Gingrich created the Center for what's it called? The Center for Health Transformation. Don't you love that name? The Center for Health Transformation. What do you transform health into? Why, of course, sickness. And that's what Newt was about. Anyway, Gingrich created the center, which he portrays as a think tank, promoting innovative ways to improve healthcare delivery and save money. Why, of course, that's what it is. Companies and trade groups and people who want Newt's vast store of knowledge available, well, they pay annual fees ranging from $20,000 to $200,000. And the higher up you go, the more direct access you have to the vast mind of Newt Gingrich. So here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the absolute pluperfect candidate for the Republican Party to be president of the United States. Can I get an amen? Thank you. I'll see you tomorrow night. I'm Mike Malloy. Take care. Keep it lit.
Becky, thank you.